From SBR News, this is Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. Many local news outlets in the Inland Northwest, including Spokane Public Radio, have just a few reporters to cover stories in their communities. Washington State University Communications Professor Ben Shores has made it his mission to add to the state's local news workforce. He's working with a national nonprofit, Report for America, to place at least one new reporter in each of Washington's 39 counties. We'll talk with Shores and with Rob Zeski from Report for America about how they'll do that. And we'll do a Washington legislative session midpoint check-in with Stevens County Republican Senator Shelley Short. We'll talk about a potential income tax, two initiatives to the legislature, and bills that she's working on. That's this week's Inland Journal. Local news reporting has been a shrinking industry in the Northwest. During the last few years, many newspapers have closed or reduced the size of their staffs. Many radio and TV stations are doing less local news gathering as well. Last May, we produced two programs about the state of local news in the Northwest. You can hear our series at SpokanePublicRadio.org. We learned about a survey done by two Washington State University researchers. They found that more than 350 outlets in Washington do local news, but they also found many rural areas are unserved by local media.
We found five counties that only had one outlet, another five counties that only had two outlets, and we also found that there were certain places in the state that had no qualifying news outlets, which means that they're news deserts.
Jennifer Henriksen is one of the authors of the WSU study.
So we found that civic leaders had a lot of concerns about the lack of local news, about how local news is being increasingly hit financially, how there are increasing news deserts, again, those counties that don't have any sources of local news available to them. There's also what's called a rise of ghost newspapers, or basically when an outlet exists in name but has to do the same amount of work with dwindling staff and fewer resources to try to reach the communities in which they are located. So it's not just journalists who care about this. It is civic leaders. It's people in the community who are leading foundations. It's policymakers. And it also should concern, and I do think it concerns a fair number of everyday individuals who want to see their papers and their outlets provide them information so that they can make decisions about their lives.
This is the study's co-author, Paul Popiel.
I will only add that businesses in particular are also a little concerned about this because they're losing outlets in which to advertise both their products and services.
Jen, there's the question, who owns these various media organizations, whether they be nonprofit like ours or whether they be for-profit like a lot of the media organizations? What did you find in terms of who owns the local news outlets around the state?
Yes, we actually found that a majority of the local news outlets are companies that tend to be private family-owned companies or nonprofits or locally or community-owned organizations. And that's good news because these are ownership types that are most likely to produce locally situated news coverage. But we also found that nearly one-third of Washington's news outlets belong to national chains. And that can be troubling because sometimes what happens is when a national chain gets ownership of a local news outlet, it results in staff layoffs, it results in reduced coverage, it results in less local coverage, and that obviously has pretty important implications and consequences for the survival of local news in a state.
I'd like to highlight the fact that nearly 50% of the outlets that we identified in the state have budgets of less than $250,000. This means that they can't afford to hire and retain salaried professional journalists to cover local news in their communities. This means that they are facing resource constraints, and it is unclear how many of them will be able to continue to operate. All of this, our report, our findings, and our analysis point to a desperate need for financial resources for newsrooms to keep operating, especially locally situated ones, for ways to make the talent pipeline more resilient, since we also have learned from our data collection that's still ongoing related to staffing levels at outlets, that a lot of news outlets in the state of Washington rely on part-time labor simply because they cannot afford full-time journalists. So making that talent pipeline more resilient and robust, it should be a priority.
That's Paul Popiel and Jennifer Henriksen from the WSU Murrow College of Communication. So how do local news outlets find the resources they need to hire reporters and editors? Popiel and Henriksen's colleague, Ben Shores, has been working on that. He was one of the organizers of a WSU Reporter Fellowship program that has placed 16 early career journalists in local newsrooms in Washington for two-year stints. The state pays their salaries, not the news organizations. One disclosure, SPR shares one of those journalists, Monica Carrillo-Casas, with the Spokesman Review. WSU says those reporters have created more than 3,000 stories in print, digital, radio, and TV. Those are available to all news outlets statewide. But those journalists are approaching the end of their fellowships, and the future of the program is unclear. Shores has another plan in mind. He's working with the nonprofit Report for America. It's a privately funded program that places news reporters at local outlets around the country.
We're going to put a journalist in every county in Washington state to cover important civic affairs in those communities. And that's local government, it's public health issues, it's their schools, and it's also just life in their communities. We know that there are several counties across Washington that have little to no local news coverage. And so we're partnering with Report for America to place 39 journalists across the state.
Rob, what does Report for America bring to the table here? What's your expertise? Rob Zeski is the president and chief executive of Report Local. That's the home organization for Report for America.
Yeah, I think we've built a program over the past 7-8 years that's placed now nearly 800 reporters in 450 newsrooms in every corner of the United States. And so I think we believe we're bringing some strong efficiency, some operational support that's going to allow us to help work on the great foundation that Murrow has built in the state, but bring some expertise, efficiency, a huge pipeline of really diverse journalists that will be excited to be in Washington State. And I think a history of training that's allowed us to also make sure we're supporting, as Ben said, both the journalists, sometimes in harder to reach newsrooms that we know is really important, right? We want to make sure that the journalists have that typically early career have a fantastic experience, but also make sure that we're providing support around editorial, fundraising, business operations of local newsrooms, because we know that that's going to be critical both to good reporting from those very reporters, but also for the ultimate systematic sustainability of the news ecosystem in Washington. And we've got a lot of experience in supporting and wrapping around training around the newsroom side of that work too. So I think we're really excited to be bringing that. In the words of one of the funding conversations that Ben and I had, and one funder who said, we want you to bring the best of the United States to Washington, right? And make sure we're seeing what good practices are looking like. And, you know, in a really tough news environment, there's still organizations that are finding ways to defy gravity and finding new models and new content solutions for readers that are excited to get it. And we want to make sure we're trying to bring the best of those things to Washington State as appropriate, right? And as is locally relevant as we can.
We're not just trying to parachute journalists into these communities and sort of hope for the best, but in partnership with Report for America, we're providing ongoing training both for the fellows and the newsrooms to help build their fundraising capacity. And we're also, you know, building networks for collaboration between newsrooms so that they can share their content and get it out to as many people as possible. So I think the goal here is not just to temporary band-aid, but actual sustainability in local news, and that's what we want to support.
So for people who are not familiar with this, the situation that local news organizations and the local news industry find themselves in, how do you sell this to them as they say, you know, the news industry is biased, and why should we care that that you're dying and that you need all this money?
Yeah, it's really is a challenge, right, Doug? We know that Americans and people around the world not only don't see the crisis in local news, they feel inundated with information and don't understand how both can necessarily be true. I think we've been working on making sure that part of our approach is how we're talking about both the value of news, we want to make sure that people understand, and we're telling the story that local news remains the most trusted form of news. And so kind of leaning into that, again, that relevance for daily lives and for community, as Ben said. But I think finally, our approach is really specific, as is Murrow's approach, which is we're trying to bring a human being into a community to be able to cover, a human being that you can call and engage with and ask questions of. And in a world that has been, in a media world that's been splintered by social media, concerns around AI, we find that a human-first approach to this is actually something that's going to be really powerful in driving trust and feels accessible to those that aren't necessarily as familiar with the challenge of local news right now.
The Murrow Fellowship program is well underway. Can you tell me, how would you evaluate how well it's worked here in Washington?
You see their impact in a variety of ways, from impacts on local government, public policy, all the way down to just community level news, whether it's engagement with local events and sports teams. One of my favorite stories out of the fellowship was produced by our Murrow Fellow in Snohomish County, who reported on the financial distress of a hygiene center for unhoused people. Because of that reporting, one of the readers of that outlet, Rick Steves, saw that story and then went and said, well, I want to help out, and provided more than $2 million to actually purchase the building and support the program. There's all sorts of different metrics that we can use, and those metrics are really important because I think people need to realize that even if you don't read the news, you can benefit from it, right? It produces positive change in these communities. We see more informed local voters. We see greater community engagement, higher voter turnout, more people running for office. But then we also see those sort of one-off stories on the saving of a local community center because somebody saw that story.
You talk about putting 39 reporters, or at least reporters, in each of the 39 counties. Do you want to highlight folks who are from the Northwest, who are from the state of Washington? And how does Report for America figure into the recruitment process for reporters?
We have a 100% retention rate now for our 16 fellows, and they're in those communities. They feel like they're part of those communities. And even when other job opportunities have come up, they've wanted to stay in those communities. So, you know, we want to look, keeping people in the communities, keeping journalists retained in the program is important. There's lots of different ways you can do that. Are there connections that they have those to those communities? We'll certainly look at people from the state, people with interest in the state. But we also think that Report for America has some phenomenal national talent that could provide a pipeline into Washington as well. So we're going to look at ways that we can talk to local stakeholders, talk to newsrooms, talk to working journalists and community members to try to bring the best local journalism to counties across the state.
Rob, do you focus on folks who are from this part of the country, or do you recruit nationwide?
Yeah, I think we'll want to do a little bit of both. And I think as we've continued to work with Washington State and Ben's team, it feels like we have an opportunity to be using the best of both of our systems for many things, which I think is the exciting part of this. Last year, we recruited for 100 new positions that we put into the field last summer in 2025. And we had nearly 1,400 applications for those, Doug, which was enormous. And so I think we're going to be certainly wanting to draw from Washington-based talent, right? I think part of what Report for America has gotten good at is building a really powerful funnel of early career journalists that are wildly talented and really diverse, right? And being able to kind of engage with different communities that we think have been underserved. And so we want to be able to cast a wide net for people who really want to be in Washington, right? And so I hope that that will be able to, you know, kind of draw on some of those folks, but also make sure that we're bringing attention to potential reporters and candidates in Washington that want to engage. I'll highlight the what Ben said earlier. You know, we're expecting this to be a kind of a three-year program for each of these fellows. So we're in it for the longer term. We've got great results. Last year, 55% of our graduates from the RFA program were hired, not just offered, were hired by their host newsrooms, which is a reflection of the good match and the long-term engagement, but also the support of the newsrooms and their ability to be able to afford holding on to those reporters after the program's over. So I think those are really important things we hope we can continue to bring to the table too.
I talk about sort of the long-term funding outlook for local news organizations. Is it going to continue to be one subscriptions to philanthropic money? Do you see governments, local governments, state governments also as long-term funders of local news?
And I think that's an all of the above. There's no doubt that that part of the reason we're here is a massive change in the business models for news, right? I mean, I think that's the assumption. And so where we've seen hope is in the ability to be diversifying funds, right? Where once there was an advertising model, that's not it anymore, right? That's just not going to be it. So I think when you say both subscriptions, I think that's right. As we think about philanthropy and knowing that maybe big dollar philanthropy, I think is going to be helpful in expansion, in scale, in investment, but it's not going to be a day-to-day solution. It's going to be about how do we find smaller dollar donations from consumers of news? And how do news organizations redesign some of their products to be appealing to a consumer rather than an advertiser who is expecting a local monopoly at one point in the business model of many news organizations? So I think that is happening, and we're seeing bright spots there, right? We're seeing organizations that are tapping into really important community issues, whether that's local sports, a community of interest of some kind, right? And so I think it's going to continue to look different. I think it will probably get a little bit smaller and more niche over time. But I think there's a lot of exciting examples of how people are helping us to see how local news can be reborn right now.
I would echo that. Right now, at this moment in time, we need kind of all three legs of that stool that you talked about, because we don't have a single magic bullet to save local journalism. We need that ongoing support from readers, subscribers, from listeners. Philanthropy is playing a crucial role, but that can't carry everything forever. And I think public funding, which has really been transformative for us at the Murrow College, needs to work alongside those other revenue streams. And so that's why we entered into this agreement with Report for America. And Rob, I think correct me if I'm wrong, but when we looked at the numbers, Report for America has helped newsrooms collectively raise more than $60 million in local donations since 2018. So there's a proven track record of, you know, economic stewardship, as well as building sustainability into those local newsrooms that I think is really critical and is so needed in those communities.
So let's finish with next steps. What needs to happen for your organizations next?
We need to have the legislature, in the words of our private funders, do its job, right? And make sure that it comes through with funding in a way that's going to be able to be supportive of this. And I think we feel like there is a ton of support. And as Ben has said, a track record of success with the fellowship program already, right? I think that's been really important for us to think about and make sure we understand. Obviously, we've got private funders who I think are excited about the idea of a match. So being able to show up and make sure we're getting private sector and private philanthropy engaged in this in the long term. And for us, we're really eager, as Ben alluded to make sure that our Report for America team is showing up with financial sustainability tools to be able to kind of further match that, right, in among all of our local newsrooms. And so that's really exciting. I think that's a powerful opportunity for funders and supporters of local news in the state of Washington. But those are the things that we really need to have happen.
You know, we need all those pieces to come together. We need the public funding to be sustained. We need philanthropic support to step up, community support. We need newsrooms to be committed to this, and we need collaboration. And we also just need to be learning throughout this process and adapting what works. And if we have things that don't work, we need to address those. We think if we do that, we've got a really clear vision for what can work in the immediate future in Washington State. But we also want to think not just about what can work in Washington State, but can this be a model that other states can follow? Can we build something with real community impact, demonstrated results that we can take back and we can show to public policymakers, we can show to philanthropic foundations? That evidence on the ground is going to be critical to ongoing support and education. And we've seen that both through both of these programs so far.
That's Ben Shores, the chairman of the Department of Journalism and Media Production at Washington State University's Murrow College of Communications. He also directs the college's fellowship program. Rob Zeski is the chief executive of Report Local, the home of Report for America. Listening to Inland Journal. Washington legislators are about halfway through their off-year 60-day session. They have to figure out how to balance a budget that's projected to be several billion dollars in the red. The majority Democrats have made news by proposing what they call a millionaire's tax. It's designed to raise money to keep paying for services while minimizing further cuts. The minority Republicans are complaining that a tax on the wealthy will eventually become an income tax for everyone. Stevens County Republican Senator Shelley Short agrees with that, and we'll get to that. But first, I asked for her overall impression of the session thus far.
If I were to step back and just take a look at it overall, regardless of whether it's legislation or budget, I would say it's about the state influence into our local communities. You know, the state wanting to go a particular direction when our communities don't. And, you know, we're a diverse state. We have communities, Native American communities all across the state. And yet the state wants to usurp itself on top of where we live and where we work and do business. And I think that's how I would characterize it from a policy perspective. And then obviously from a budgetary perspective, super concerned about coming in and potentially enacting an income tax at a time when just last year, you know, there were $12 billion in increased taxes. You know, to me, it just signals that there's never enough. And that concerns me when you consider, you know, just foundational things the state should do. You know, the services for individuals with disabilities, our communities, wildfire, and all of that. If we try to do too many things and be everything to all people, then I think we risk not doing the things we should do along with funding education. And so I just really concerned that it, to me, it feels out of control.
Let's talk about the two initiatives proposed by Brian Haywood that have been qualified to go before the legislature. You were part of a listening session last week in Olympia that focused on those.
You know, on the Parents' Rights Initiative, I feel there's more and more movement toward pushing parents out of the picture, which is pretty stunning. We're talking about our public education system and really using that to push parents away. And we heard stories from, you know, both parents and educators themselves and professionals, psychologists, about the importance of keeping families together. And even when children are going through really tough times and maybe the parents don't agree with the child, they need that foundation. They need that center, if you will, that they use to have safety and experience life. And obviously, we're not talking about situations where there's been abuse or neglect or anything like that. But that initiative really puts the parents back into the equation, which it did 2 years ago when there was significant bipartisan support for it before it was changed. The second one, I don't have a problem with transgender individuals like that. I am not, this is not about them. But what it is about is really coming over the top of our young girls, our women, and saying, well, you have to give up your spaces. You have to give up your athletics, you know, in terms of the competitive part. And really, you know, girls have shared, both athletes and just girls in general, how it's really hard to have young men who are still men physically in their locker rooms. When we think about how hard, you know, really the country, our nation has fought for women's rights and the right to be individual, the right to have, you know, those equal opportunities, really feel like that is being hurt here in significant ways. So again, we heard from athletes, you know, they've suffered tremendous hate, and just some of the comments that have been thrown their way are really offensive and really putting families at risk, schools giving them the cold shoulder, all of that. And really what they want is just an equal opportunity, you know, to showcase how hard they've worked. I think definitely there should be consideration of additional athletics for transgender individuals. But really, throughout our time, you know, you and I as adults, when we were children and really children today, there have always been effeminate boys and kind of, you know, hardcore girls. They've continued to participate in their own sports. And we think that's the way forward. But it's really troubling to me when we tell our girls, you know, your bodies are your own, trust your instincts, you know, create safe spaces and really draw that line. And really, with a transgender issue, we're really telling girls that doesn't matter and that you need to just be willing to let that line be crossed. And I think that's a really dangerous message.
Now that it appears those initiatives are going to the ballot, do you have a feel for how they'll do?
I mean, as far as the parents' rights issue, before the legislature adopted the initiative 2 years ago, tremendously popular. I mean, parents were rising up. I think post-COVID, they really saw how really schools were stepping in to the role as pseudo-parent, if you will. And it is still a huge issue. I believe there will be tremendous support for it. I know there's also going to be a lot of money, especially union money, against it. I think the parents are standing up and just saying, you know what, these are our children, they're not yours. And so I think it will definitely, you know, pass come November. As far as the girls' athletics, I think the same thing. You know, this is just really about fairness in sports, about women being able to protect themselves, you know, from harm's way. And I think, too, it'll have significant success come November.
I want to give you a chance to talk about one of your own bills. What are you passionate about this year?
Well, particularly wildfire. I don't know whether my bill will advance or it will be part of the budget discussion, but, you know, there was a bill that passed several years ago. We dub it 1168. That was the bill at the time that Hillary Franz, our past lands commissioner, worked to champion. And that was really significant money for DNR to coordinate firefighting assets, to coordinate with local fire districts, local communities, do forest health treatments, all of those things, pre-position firefighting assets, you know, all of that takes money. And we have seen significant, it's just been unreal how well it's worked. You and I know that we're going to have wildfire in our communities, but it could have been so much worse last year and it wasn't because of their efforts. So last year it was not fully funded. And so basically our continued push this year is to have that money, at least temporarily for a couple of years, come out of the Climate Commitment Act revenue. And we think that when it comes to wildfire emissions and things like that, that it's really a good fit. Now, should it be there permanently? Probably not. But we think it would be advantageous to continue to support full funding of that.
Shelley Short is a Republican who represents the 7th Legislative District in Olympia. Inland Journal is the weekly public affairs program produced by SPR News. It's on the radio every Thursday at 12:30 and every Saturday at 2:30. It's online anytime at SpokanePublicRadio.org. That's where you can find our daily SPR News Today podcast hosted by Owen Henderson. Thank you for listening. I'm Doug Nadvornik.